kicking it for real, yo, in Bantertown.
What?
Back in MJ with JW. How you doing, Johnny?
I'm good. I'm a little haggard. I had a flight, as you know. I just came straight from the airport.
You came straight from the airport and went straight to lunch with me. I was honored.
Beautiful. We had a nice lunch at Cheddar's.
Yeah.
Not a sponsor.
Not a sponsor, but boy, you can eat there for cheap, and I like that.
It is. It's like they're built for church culture. I've noticed that. It's a big, like, youth group. You can go out after. You know, you see a lot of that on Wednesday nights. Like, people go out because it's like kids can – you can get a burger there for $7 or $8 and not break the bank.
Yeah, you really can. And,
you're sitting in a nice booth, and it's a nice – so it's kind of like – almost like a fast casual with a nicer ethos.
Right. Oh, nice.
You like that?
Nice big word there. Ethos.
I know words.
Yeah.
I know words.
It's ethos.
I've got the best words.
It's ethos. Yeah. Anyway, I don't really – it's still my favorite joke
of
yours.
The Greek god of ambience, I think.
My favorite joke of yours still, and you've been telling it ever since I've known you.
What is it?
And it's your T-shirt now.
Oh, right.
That I don't speak Latin
per se.
I know that was Greek, but, you know, it still gets me. Just those two words.
That's one of my favorite things ever, and it's not been super lucrative.
Has it not?
No, the other T-shirts do way better. It's just a little cerebral, I guess. That's easy to say. I read a great thing the other day, and it was like whenever you hear a comedian say, like, it was a really smart crowd, all they mean is they really liked me.
Right.
Like, you never hear a comedian go, it was a really smart crowd, they hated me. They knew enough to hate me.
To know that I'm an idiot. Yeah. Oh, that's
I don't know. I think living in the South, you grow up with like a defensiveness in our just like intrinsic in your being of I'm as smart as everybody else because we get called dumb so much. People imagine they have a picture in their head of what a Tennessee person is.
Yeah.
And so you spend your life trying to be like, I know things.
Right.
It's so dumb. It's like a chip on your shoulder.
I had an interview yesterday for a possible project that I'm working on, and I found myself trying actively to de-southernize my voice.
Yeah.
One time I said, "Cause I come on upper," and I felt it coming out. You know,
no. was it too late?
Well, I stopped it. I repeated myself as if it was kind of like, you know,
"Cause I come on upper," is what an idiot would say. What I'm saying is,
I was like, I mean, I
inevitably, irrevocably.
I don't think it. No, it was. I think I didn't get the whole. I may be exaggerating. It was more like an ah. I had an ah, and
yeah.
I stopped and turned it into an I. You know, I.
My mom used to say Italian. Did your mom say Italian?
My grandfather says Italian.
Let's go out for Italian. I have a joke now that I talk about where. And it's kind of a true story. I was in a green room, and there was a menu for this bistro, and they were cooking. You know, you could order from that, and they would bring it in.
Right.
It was in all Italian. Like, there was no English words on it, and I was panicked because I didn't want to look like an idiot. But I didn't know what some of these words were, and so I said, do you know what cavatappi is? And the whole – this really happened.
Yeah.
And they said, I think that's corkscrew pasta. And I said, I thought that was rotini. And they said, yeah, I think you're right. And then I said, well, maybe it goes the other way. And so I say that in my show now, but what I say is like, to set that up is, I didn't grow up around real Italian food. Like Chef Boyardee is my chef, you know?
Right.
Like, or on a real fancy night, we might go out to Olive Garden. What? Put on the dressy shorts. Like that's my, put on the good sweatpants. We're going to Olive Garden.
Oh, that's great.
But yeah, I did find this out. I don't know how you delve into your family history more than me. I'm one of those guys that's like, I didn't know a lot of my extended family growing up just for different reasons. We had some cancer deaths, and I didn't have a strong relationship with my grandparents. And then they passed and on one side of my family, and then the other lived way over in Kentucky, and
yeah.
We just didn't work close. And so I didn't grow up with this sense of, like, I've got to find out who I am. You're more of that guy. But I did find this out about my father-in-law the other day. He was born with 6 toes on each foot.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
Can you imagine the balance on this dude? They cut him off. Because when you're young, evidently, it's like there's hardly any bone or anything. And then you just go, and we fixed you, and you're done.
Wow.
And so he just has this little, like, nubbin or whatever. I don't know what's there now.
He'd be like a Hall of Fame running back.
Can you imagine?
Oh, my goodness.
Just weebles wobble, but
wow,
not so much. That was fascinating. Because you hear about 6 toes, but I've never heard 6 toes on each foot.
That's amazing.
So I'm telling you,
he's a well balanced man.
He is. He could have been a duck.
That's fascinating.
Can you imagine the swimming? like the extra the extra torque that he could create. It's like
flippers. Man, that would have
been like performance enhancing.
Yeah.
Borderline there.
Wow. Wow.
They start counting toes before the big Olympic meet. Hey, get out of here, buddy.
You ever seen Michael Phelps' feet? Who knows, bro?
That's true. He could have some. Have you ever seen Shaq's feet?
No.
So Shaq is super funny, and you know he's very self-deprecating and stuff right. on inside the NBA. And they goof on each other. And I can't remember what the reason was, but one day he took off his shoe and his sock, and his foot is a disaster.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
It is. I need to show you. I'll show you a picture in real time. Hang on. I've got it saved on my phone because I was sharing it with a buddy the other day.
And you out there right now listening, you can Google Shaq's foot.
Yeah. Google Shaquille O'Neal foot. And hang on. I'm going to find it. It is jarring how jacked up a rich, famous person's foot is. Because you just imagine they have different feet than us. Okay, I'm going to bring it over to you. Hang on a second.
I don't think I imagined that they had different feet. Okay, hold on. Can you just text it to me?
This is the...
Oh, dear.
So, that look how jacked up that part is. Now, watch. Let me show you the close-up. Hold on. Look at this extra meat here.
What in the...
That's the sixth toe, John.
Wow.
Then there's these other two what-have-yous. It's like the weight of his 350-plus pounds just kind of... and made extra toe holes.
Wow.
Extra toe nubs that came out.
I hope you all heard everything Johnny just said outside of his microphone, but
no
extra nubs and toe holes.
I'm telling you, and this dude played professional sports with these feet.
Wow.
And I mean, I'm talking about Shaquille gets this thing of like, well, he's just the biggest guy. He bowls people over. You watch an old Shaquille highlight, dude, that dude's a ballerina. The footwork he had. To get open and move around.
And now
people.
Knowing what kind of feet he was on with that
Well,
footwork.
He would miss games, and they would say he has turf toe or whatever, he has a foot issue. And now I realize, yeah, I mean, that's the thing with big people, too. They say that the circulation is never great because it's like your heart has to push blood through all. I mean, if you're like 7'3", like he is, it's like your feet are getting the last. You're not getting the good blood.
Yeah.
They're getting the last of the blood. And so.
Not getting the good blood.
They're not getting the good blood. I'm not a scientist. But so, yeah, so you have feet problem, you have numbness, you have neuropathy and things. And so, but those feet, I couldn't believe, I would never take my sock off.
Not for
my wife. Like, he did it with cameras.
Right, and allowed people to photograph it. Wow, that's amazing. I wish I had the kind of security that that Shaq has.
Just financial security.
Right, or just the armed guards or whatever. You know?
I just think he's like, whatever, I got jacked up feet, who cares?
Right, who cares?
But yeah. Maybe not.
In my family history, I don't know. And so this is an interesting story.
Yeah.
And we're in my office right now again. There's a frame up here on the wall there to your right, my left.
Right.
So I was always told, so I'm just going to tell all the listeners a fascinating story. It really is fascinating, Johnny.
I started this with the family history thing.
You did this to yourself.
But my story's about extra toes. Yours is going to be like the Revolutionary War.
Civil War. Oh, have you know? But so I was always told that there's a guy named Captain William Driver.
Right.
No, he's real. And you can go Google him if you want. And the thing I was told is that we were related to him. Mm-hmm. Captain William Driver had the original flag that was called Old Glory. So if we call the American flag Old Glory, it was his flag. He came up with the name. He was a captain in the 1830s.
Is Betsy Ross in here somewhere?
No. That was Star Spangled Banner. So
no, that was Francis Scott Key.
He wrote that song. She did the original.
But she did the flag, right?
Correct, but that's a different era.
Okay.
This is 1830s, okay? That was like 1776 time.
Okay.
No, Star-Spangled Banner is 1812, War of 1812.
Yeah.
At any rate. So Betsy Ross had been before that.
Yeah.
So I correct myself. But she had the first, like, flag, supposedly. Who knows? And then, yes, Star-Spangled Banner was the song written by Francis Scott Key,
mm-hmm.
but it would have been like the kind of flag she made. Well, anyway, he had an American flag that his mom and a bunch of the ladies from the town made for him before he embarked upon his first journey around the world out of Salem, Massachusetts. They put it up over the ship, and he said, I'll call her Old Glory. And it's a huge, huge flag, and that's where Old Glory happened. So he sailed for 20, 30 years all over the world, did a bunch of crazy stuff. And his wife died. So he came home and he moved to Nashville.
Yeah.
and lived out his days. And then in the 1860s, so well before the Civil War, his flag was so famous here that he was down on Fifth Avenue, and all the parades on like patriotic holidays would go right past his house, and they would hang the flag. It was so big it would cross the street from two buildings, basically.
What?
Then march underneath it on their way to the Capitol.
And people would have terrible accidents because it's blocking the street.
Well, it was above them. Oh. It was above them. You, okay. You marched below it, so yeah.
Okay.
Try to keep up.
Okay.
And so then the war breaks out, and the Nashville, there's like not really a battle at first. They just kind of fall to Confederate occupation. Of course, he is this staunch Unionist, very, very anti-slavery. He actually ran for mayor of Nashville.
This is why you hoped that he was your relative, because he was on the right side of history, right?
He was on the side of history. It was like, oh, wow, yeah. I mean, but he wrote all kinds of like articles in the newspapers and everything out against slavery. And he lost the mayoral race, you know, but he was actually a councilman and all kinds of different things. But really, really outspoken, like old codger, like willing to say anything. He was in his 60s at that point. So the Confederates came to his door, like Confederate sympathizers, and demanded Old Glory. They were going to take it and destroy it. And he basically – and there's all kinds of stuff. I've been to the Tennessee State Museum, and there's a lot of like original artifacts and things. You can read his handwriting about all this stuff because he wrote tons of stuff.
Yeah.
And he basically said the equivalent of, you can pry it from my cold, dead hand.
Oh, wow.
And so they came in and searched his house like five times and never could find the flag. Well, then eventually when Nashville fell, there was some shelling and other things. There was a battle of Franklin and things around here. But Nashville, basically, the Confederates, when the Union came, just kind of skipped town. And so he, after the Union had retaken Nashville, went into his house, went upstairs, got a quilt. And he cut it open, and he had his neighbor – he wouldn't even tell his wife or his daughters – had a neighbor sew the flag into this quilt, and he had slept under it. Just imagine the imagery here from a writing standpoint. They couldn't find the flag, and he's like sleeping under it every night.
That's a great story.
It's unbelievable. He marched out with the Union garrison, and this old guy marched with them down Fifth Avenue all the way to the Capitol, climbed to the top, and helped them raise Old Glory back over Nashville. And Nashville was never again not under Union occupation after that.
Dude, why aren't you writing this book?
Well, it
writes itself, the U.S. of Duvet. You've got to write this book. He had a comforter with the flag sewn into
amazing.
It.
It's amazing. It's a true story.
That's unbelievable.
It's all, and so, and Old Glory, Old Glory's in the Smithsonian. Our friends Jeffrey and Allison just went and saw it. I mean, you can go see it. And it comes to the Tennessee State Museum sometimes on a tour. But I wanted to call the book Chasing Old Glory because I was.
U.S. of Duvet is better, but whatever.
Yeah, whatever. So, but the idea is I want to find my connection to this guy. So that's to your previous point.
And then you find out that you're not, though.
I can't make a connection. Oh, sorry. I just hit the thing here.
So have you done like a real search?
Oh, yeah.
Though?
I did. I have done.
Ancestry or whatever?
I did Ancestry.com, a lot of research. I hired my buddy as a research assistant for a while. We were doing all kinds of things at the State Museum, the whole deal. I can write this story still. We still share the same last name and everything. But the best I can tell, we're not related to him, like the Massachusetts driver. We're probably related back in England somewhere or Ireland, to be honest with you. I even sent him a spit, by the way.
Oh, well,
yeah.
Okay.
Have you done that?
No, the 23andMe and all that?
Well, Ancestry, you can send in your DNA, and it will tell you all these connections and tell you
where
you're
almost
from.
A little scared. You know, that you're always like, people always imagine that they come from good stock, and I'm always like, I have a feeling there's some rogues and heels in my – there's not some – you don't want to find out that like, oh, yeah, yeah. So right as they were about to set the slaves free – your great-great-grandfather sold him back into, you know, whatever.
Right.
It's
no.
Like, you don't want to be that guy.
Well, and that's the thing. So even Captain William, he had four sons.
Yeah.
And, like, two of them fought for the Confederacy and two fought for the Union. And he disowned one. And he's buried in the Nashville City Cemetery over there off of 4th Avenue.
Why doesn't he get a statue?
He has a huge monument his – no, he designed it.
All right. That's
some
kind of okay.
Might think is a little. It's like this tree stump. It's there. You can look at it. That's the monument.
It's a stump,
and it's got an American flag got wrapped around it, and it's got all kinds of stuff from like he freed the descendants of the mutineers on the Bounty.
Yeah,
they were on an island dying of disease, and they paid him, and he picked them up and transported them from to Tahiti, I think, and now they live there like they're like a big population of people. And anyway,
I got a new title for the book.
Here we go.
Liberty Undercover.
That'll work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Liberty Undercover.
Mm. Mm. You think?
I like it. I really ought to just write it and not worry about the whole journey to make my connection.
But it's got to have. Have you done enough research on, because you've done like an adapted screenplay, and you've done other things like this where you need a log line to sell things.
Yeah.
It's like, describe to me what you're working on in two sentences, and if you can't do it, then you need to scrap it until you can.
The Civil War angle is what makes it to me.
Yeah.
His story previously is fascinating. There's all kinds of like naval adventures and things, but that's where I'd start the book. I would start the whole, or the movie.
It could be a movie. It really could.
To me, it's like a mini series. Like, you kind of, you know, but this guy.
The Civil War stuff is kind of, 2018 is a weird time, because it's like we're in danger now of just kind of whitewashing history and deciding that, like, because we weren't happy with the politics of the day, that we're going to just ignore that it ever happened or whatever.
Right.
When there's so much we can learn from it.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a lot.
And he was on the right side, so there's a chance it could be made. You never know.
Right. There's a lot to be said for, you know, here's the deal. Obviously, against slavery, I do believe that, and that's called modernism. We talk about that sometimes on the podcast.
Yeah.
You know, modernism is judging past events by modern historical standards. But I'm actually reading a book right now. I'm really nerding out on it. It's this huge book I got at Costco because I love Costco books. And I love Costco clothes because you don't have to try them on. That's amazing. And
wait a minute. You mean that they just fit poorly?
Well, no, you just, you know, hope that they work.
Maybe you just have a nice average frame and you just are lucky.
Well, yeah,
I would have to try on Costco clothes.
It's probably medium. You know, I just kind of get it. Or large.
Yeah, you're a medium guy.
I'm on keto. I'm getting back down to a medium.
Beautiful.
But listen, the truth is the Costco books, which is where I want my book when it comes out in January.
Why would you not want that?
I want it so
bad.
Wasn't
that the big scandal, though, that was like ended up being false, that Costco put the Bible in the fiction, on the fiction table, and
every
pastor in the world was sharing it like, how dare they?
Oh.
And then people were getting a boycott, and it was wrong.
Just been somebody shelved it wrong.
It was a total like fabrication. I think it ended up being like Photoshop. They photoshopped the sign on the table.
Who would do that?
Somebody trying to rile up the evangelical base, you know?
Yeah.
Against the evils of corporate America.
Even then, I hate the whole idea that, obviously the Bible is not fiction to me. But I hate the whole idea that if somebody hurls an accusation at God, that we're going to have to all jump to his defense. Because the creator of the universe can't take care of things. He's not going to be able to handle this, guys. We got to rise up for him.
There was a pastor friend of mine that posted something to that degree today that reminded me of what you just said. And it was something to the effect of, like, when you have haters online. Hang on, I'll find it. It was something about haters. If you have haters online.
You're not going to get up and come over here again, are you?
No.
Okay.
You're funny, John. Hang on, I'll find it.
I do think in the story, while you're finding it, in the story, the idea that he had a son or two who fought for the other side, even being raised in his family, it would at least say that there is complexity to it. I obviously agree. And the book I'm reading now is about John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and their relationship.
Yeah.
And it talks about the fact, and I just read a chapter last night about the fact that we act as if nobody understood that slavery was wrong. I mean, there was so much anti-slavery sentiment happening. And when they're writing the Declaration of Independence, and it's actually after all the states had written a lot of their own declarations, and they didn't think it would be that big of a deal because they thought the states had already done it. And it became this much bigger deal. But they're writing about equality, and the guy who is the main, craftsman of the language is one of the largest slaveholders in Virginia. And they talked about how he reconciled, because a lot of the Southern patriots, they found a way to go a different direction in their mind. They found a way to shift their paradigm in a way that says, and some of them, there's all kinds of writings where they say all people, look, and that's part of the Enlightenment thinking, is that you're not as much a result of your nature as you are of your environment and your opportunities, and that all men can be created equal, and that all men have opportunity to, if given the best opportunity, to become, it still had a lot of problems because they weren't saying like, hey, you're just equal where you are. They're saying you have the ability to be equal if given the best education and given the right opportunity. And if you pull yourself up, then you can be on the level with the aristocracy.
Right, imperialism.
But they still believe in an aristocracy.
Yeah.
That's why it's a Republican government where it's not just rule of the people, but the aristocracy and the Senate and the executive branch would help control. So – But the idea, though, is fascinating. I would love to write this in the book or in the movie. I mean, it's fascinating that it wasn't just probably all this this purely enlightened 2018 thinking of all people exactly as they are, regardless of their status or state in life, are exactly the same. They were beginning to believe, and it was revolutionary, obviously, that all people had, if given the same opportunities, mm-hmm. could rise to that. And the funniest thing about it, the whole thing is that England had already abolished slavery. Like, and so they're claiming equal rights for all humans at the same time that they're basically now saying, oh, except for this kind of human, we don't believe has the capacity to have the same rights. In fact, Thomas Jefferson believed, according to this book, that the African slaves literally were not capable of the same level of growth. But he thought Native Americans, who were often just as much mistreated and they were wiped out, that they did because of it's all about what they consider to be civilization.
Right.
He evaluated their artistry and their music and all mm-hmm. kinds of other things because to him, it's a real Greek mindset. Those who can appreciate, you know, architecture and art and other things, that's a measurement of your ability or your capacity to grow into civilized society. So he literally just summed up these two groups of people. The architect of independence had this total major faux pas in thinking, and probably because he had so much to lose. He would have known that probably in his mindset, but that he had so much to lose financially. But there was a big movement at the time that American independence was happening to go ahead and abolish slavery. In fact, Jefferson was writing some of it, and the Virginians just shot it all down. Even though he didn't believe it, he still thought slavery was an institution that was not going to last long term, as it already had been abolished in New England around John Adams' time. So, hey, just took you down a little bit of a road there. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, but it's fascinating to me.
You roll like the little Civil War drum music and some Ken Burns. Oh, my gosh. So this is that tweet I was telling you about. Empowerment tech. This is from my friend Bo Chansey, who's a pastor in New England. Empowerment technique number one, you do not have to respond when people attack you online. It's more fun knowing that they will spend their whole day refreshing the page but never find the fight they were looking for. That's great.
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah. If you don't feed the trolls sometimes, you're just like, I bet they're refreshing seeing if I respond to this.
Yeah. I mean, I've only had a few troll experiences, but yeah. I think even of those of us who understand what the internet is, there's always that shock and awe that somebody could be absolutely so rude and ruthless, you know.
And say something they would never say to your face. That's the hard part, too.
Yeah.
People get emboldened, and we're living in a very emboldened time for people who are not the best.
Well, my wife was talking about that. There's a lot of articles and podcasts out about, and we discussed it at lunch a little bit, about the polarization of political mindsets and viewpoints in America, and that if you really think about it, you know, during the previous administration, which is considered to be very liberal by a lot of people's standards, you know, it was not very moderate. There's not a lot of room for moderation in that viewpoint. And then now the current administration, very, very polarizing on the conservative side, not a lot of room for moderates, and moderate voices are so getting lost in the middle. In fact, you're accused, if you have a moderate voice, by either side of being liberal or ultra-conservative.
You're wishy-washy. You're not helping anybody if you have a moderate thought.
But the truth is that most of American history has been built around the fact that the reason that systems are built with checks and balances the way they are is so that a moderate viewpoint mm-hmm. can exist. And there's got to be some way to have that dialogue in the middle.
Well, and that's the hard part about evangelicalism when it gets mixed up in government, too, is because evangelicalism is built on this burden of certainty that I don't even know for sure is one of those things that's even inherent in the gospel. But I was certainly raised with that idea that, like, we're right, they're wrong, and God love them, they just don't know any better, but they're dangerous because they don't know any better.
Yep.
And you just live your life with this assuredness. And so when you start having politicians who fall in line to try to get these votes, they want you to fall in line 100%. And so when you start saying, well, I need to be able to reach across the aisle and come to a compromise on healthcare with you, we don't compromise. Like, compromise is like the worst thing you can say to an evangelical.
Oh, yeah.
But government's built on compromise because everybody brings their ideas to the table and we're supposed to be able to get things done. And honestly, when people talk about gridlock in government, gridlock is what's kind of supposed to happen in government.
It is.
It's supposed to be butting heads so that some drastic, huge thing doesn't happen when one party gets in power.
Right.
That's going to set – because that's the main thing. If you ever talk to anybody that's in government, ever been in government, I had a conversation with somebody who used to be a state senator, and they said the number one thing I learned that was the huge danger in government, it's not people with agendas and evil plots. It's unintended consequences of well-meaning laws.
Oh, yeah.
You pass a thing – and then somebody finds a loophole around that thing, or now all of a sudden, because you passed the thing that said that the oil pipeline is going to come into Alaska and it's going to bring all this money to the region, now you've killed the ecosystem,
right?
Or people that live there, or an Indian tribe, or whatever it is. Those things are so huge. And so if you just go, I'm just going to vote in the party line, and I'm just going to do whatever the people who, you know, if you get into populism – that's the danger, is you just start rubber stamping everything, and these unintended consequences, they pile up.
Yeah.
And you've built a whole other country that you weren't intending to.
No, absolutely. There is, in our lifetime and actually presently, you know, we have opportunities to be involved in somebody's journey who, you know, they're struggling with certain things. My dad, before he passed, he spent his whole life either working in the public school system in Nashville, Metro Schools. His school had 31 language groups. It was a gang-infested area. It's actually the largest Kurdish population outside of the Middle East exists in Nashville.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah. And so Dad was constantly involved in trying to help kids and help people through and keeping them safe. And he was kind of considered the discipline guy of a school of like, 2,000 kids. Where there's
he was the lean on me. He was the Joe Clark.
He's a lot. And kids would trust him, you know, with life and death information that he could go act on. In fact, one time's a great story. One time, it's this kid, and it was going to court. This kid had come to Dad in private to tell him something he needed to know that was, I think, is probably a gang issue or something else.
Yeah.
And Dad acted on it. And when the whole thing went to court, the judge told Dad that he needed to give up his source. But Dad knew everything about his job with those kids was based upon the trust that they could trust him and he would protect them. And so literally, I remember I was a kid. Dad came home from court and the judge said, you need to go home and you need to sleep tonight and you're going to come back tomorrow. And if you don't tell me who your source is, I'm ordering you to, I'm going to hold you in contempt and throw you in jail.
Man.
And so Dad went home and we literally started praying, like, because Dad might be going to jail tomorrow. He's like, and I think the judge said, bring your toothbrush back with you.
Wow.
Because you're going to be here a while, kind of thing. And so we went home and prayed, and Dad was like just a man of principle. He's like, I can't. He was a principal of principle, huh?
Man,
and he was just like, there you go. And he just couldn't make peace because that would forever keep kids.
Well,
from
and you
kind
of could put that kid in danger too, right? If there's gang culture or whatever, you can put him in danger of being a rat or whatever.
And I don't remember the exact situation, but it was something dangerous.
Yeah.
And I remember the next day when he went back after we prayed about it, there was a different judge that day.
Oh.
Like somebody else filled in and they dropped the whole thing.
And
they didn't require him to do that. And we just felt like our prayers obviously were heard. And what a blessing that was. But, you know.
But he would have gone. He would have just gone to jail.
He would. Oh, yeah. He would have done it.
That's unbelievable, dude.
Yep.
Yeah, your dad was something else.
But Dad had a gentleman for our lawn care business that is still a friend of ours today who, he's in his 50s and he was in trouble when he was in his teens and was just in a cycle. You know, and he made some bad choices, but Dad, led him to faith and loved him, and we still love him to this day. And one of the things about his situation that was difficult was he had children who were grown, like in their 30s, but he owed back payment on not alimony, but child support. Sorry, I lost it. He owed child support, and he didn't have a job in pay, and so. This is the thing, like one of the things in Tennessee law, to your point, is they take away your driver's license.
Okay.
And so he has a real hard time holding down a job.
Yeah, now you can't get a job because...
It's Nashville, it's pretty wide, it's pretty spread out.
It's a weird punishment.
It took away his driver's license.
It's like it hamstrings you to ever be able to pay it back ever because you're punishing him for not paying to begin with.
And it compounds to the point where at some point after 10, 15 years, you're in the hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
And a guy who's... even if he had a car, where he is with his education, everything else, like he's not going to be able to make much above poverty level right. type pay, and he can't get to work right mm-hmm. now. And so he can't dig out. Like that is a hole. And it's easy to say, well, yeah, he shouldn't have made the bad choices, and he shouldn't. And absolutely. But
yeah.
in my life, Johnny, I made a lot of bad choices that somebody helped me through.
Yeah, heck yeah.
That the hammer didn't come down as it right. could have because there was someone going, hey, I'm not going to let this. Now, I might have been disciplined severely and dealt with some pretty severe consequences, but not in the state that would affect my life forever. Like the purpose of the discipline was to keep me from being stuck in that forever.
Right.
But and I'm sure there's a well-meaning purpose behind passing a law like that because it is a pretty severe consequence. And obviously I believe in taking care of our children. Like I understand the spirit of that. But the flip side is at some point, like you said, you go, yeah, the unintended consequence of that is the children will never be taken care of because yeah. the guy can never provide enough.
You put a scarlet A on his chest now. Yep. He can't be reformed.
Right.
He can't be redeemed from that situation.
Right.
Yeah, so that's the hard thing.
Unless he breaks the law, by the way, right. and drives without a
exactly.
license. And then that's just going to compound it again.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the hard thing about partisanship. It's like when you want to be the law and order candidate and you want to come down hard on people, that's when you end up with things like, which is so funny because that's happening now where Trump introduced a crime bill yesterday and I was watching the news about it and it's rolling back some of the stuff that Clinton, who was an extreme left-wing president, mm-hmm. but he was part of the three strikes you're out thing. So you have people who are serving life sentences for like three felonies that sometimes are like amount to possession of weed.
Right.
So there are people in jail who had three convictions of minor drug possession. And so some of that stuff's being rolled back in because we realize how racist some of it was. It was geared towards impoverished people.
Yeah.
And it was it was an imbalance in the system.
Right.
And But when you pass them like that, you're like, we're going to get tough on crime, and you get people to cheer that you're going to make their neighborhood safer. But the unintended consequence is this unfairly targets certain people groups, et cetera, and it can ruin somebody's life that makes a mistake. It's like – it's a weird thing. So I'm more of those guys – one of those guys that's like, let's figure out – there are people who have forfeited their right to be part of society. I
sure.
get that.
Sure.
But let's figure out who those people are and let's do it. Let's do this with a scalpel, not with a chainsaw. Let's do, you know what I'm saying? Let's do, yeah. if we're going to do surgery on the system, let's figure out where the cuts need to be made and let's do it. But I'm intrigued to see what happens. But yeah, you do. It's so weird that somebody would do that. Like, yeah, you can't pay. So now we're going to take away your ability to go work.
Right.
And so I don't know, man. That's so fast. I mean, and again, maybe who knows what the original intent of that law was, but man.
And there's other things, you know, I'm probably not at liberty to share right now that are very more recent in our journey with other people
yeah.
that it's not that the system's bad. It's that if you're in a place where you don't have transportation or you're serving probation or some sort of parole and then you're required within at a moment's notice to show up for this test or this class without really – and it's all over town.
Yeah.
How are they supposed to get there? If you don't show up, there is a warrant for your arrest. And again, I'm all about – I'm not being sympathetic towards crime. You know, and we went over Pastor Andrew's sermon this morning, and we're talking about John chapter 9. And we're talking about that is the man born blind. And last week it was a great two-parter. Last week he took dirt on the stage.
I saw the thing. I saw the photos of it, yeah.
And he spit in the dirt until it made mud. And somebody asked – as calculated, it takes 21 spits. Because I always preach that about that story. You probably remember that from, like, I want you to imagine what the blind guy.
Yeah.
So Jesus normally just touches people, you know,
yeah.
and heals them. So he's probably all excited. He knows Jesus is there.
Right.
And all of a sudden, imagine the sights and sounds, or more importantly for him, the sounds
yeah.
of what's happening. Jesus is spitting in a dirt enough to make clay.
Yeah.
That's a lot of spit. And what is he listening to? And what the crowd's watching? And how, like, gross and weird and awkward it is to sit there. And he's, like, probably, you know, going, what's happening now? And no one will answer. Yeah. You know, like, we don't really know. And so he did that last week, and it was great. And so this week we're talking about, though, the after story of that we often miss is what happens. It's on the Sabbath that the Pharisees come out of the woodwork, and they accuse Jesus. They know this guy was blind. Now they start, like, interrogating
yeah.
him. And then they begin interrogating his parents. And there's this threatening, and scripturally, if you see the terms thrown out of the synagogue, it doesn't mean they throw you out one time. It means they excommunicate you from the community.
Okay, yeah.
So it's a big, big deal. It's a cultural thing, not just a religious thing. Not like, you don't come back till next week. Like, no,
yeah,
you're never,
yeah,
you're ostracized now from our culture and our society. And so the parents basically wouldn't even claim their own child's healing. They just said, look, he's of age, ask him. Like, they didn't want to face, and it's kind of sad. They wouldn't stand with him, but he kind of began confronting them. They kept asking and asking the same questions. He goes, look, I don't know who the guy is. Some guy named Jesus. I don't know where he is. He spit in this mud, and all I know is now I was blind and now I see. And here's the, and they go, we don't know who this Jesus is or where he's from. He goes, there's a guy healing people of blindness. You're the religious leaders and you don't know anything about him?
Right.
Like, he really begins confronting them, and they say this, you know what? You were born a sinner. You were born into, this is what ESV says, you were born into utter sin. Who are you to teach us? Hmm. And what they're saying is we don't believe that we were born into utter sin, but your condition or your situation in life as this poverty-stricken blind guy who's begging everywhere, we have now, and they don't even know they're saying it, we have now assumed, and we're now speaking what we have always assumed inside, that you are in greater need of help from God than we are. And to your point about all the things that we can't see and how this idea that, so we're talking about the penal system and crime and other things like that. We often don't know what we can't see. Like, if I'm blind to something, the worst blindness, and Jesus even says that, he goes, I came into the world to judge. And in other words, places in John, he says, I came not to judge. But this is a different kind of judgment. What he said is, I came to judge to this end, that those who are blind would see, and those who think they see will know that they're blind.
Yeah.
Like, the greatest blindness of this life is thinking you don't have blindness.
Yeah.
Like, in saying that, hey— and then that's just that whole humility. I forget who it was, if it was Spurgeon or someone, like, hey, you can really sum up the gospel in three words, humility, humility, humility.
Yeah.
You know, and it may not have been Spurgeon, but that there is this necessity, the only real prerequisite is that I admit that I don't know everything, that my perception may not be right, that I don't have the perspective of the Creator, that I may not be completely Christ-like. And as much as I've learned or grown or done good deeds or whatever it may be, that perhaps I don't own a full viewpoint of all things that are right in all situations, and then not overlaying my experience. I mean, I think the number one thing that causes racism in people that they feel like is not racism, but they feel like is justified, is that they had an experience. And so experiences produce stereotypes, and they maybe had that experience 10, 15, 20 times over. Well, one time this happened to me and this person, and then their whole neighborhood, this is how they always acted. And when I grew up, that let me know that all people from that kind of neighborhood or speak that language or of that color must be that way, and not understanding that that could have been a true experience to where you were, but that your viewpoint may not be the global one or the universal one. And the danger we have in that, I think what Christ came to say was, listen, hey guys, the ones who are most blind spiritually in this story are the ones who said that they need it the least. And he said, I came so that those who think they see will recognize their blindness. And it's the greatest gift that he brings to us.
Dude, I got a great title for that book too.
All right, bring it.
Spitting Image. Boom.
I love it.
Oh my gosh. That's the sermon series.
Dude.
Spitting Image, John 19. Okay. So this is to your point about,
it's John 9.
John 9. Sorry. I wasn't really listening.
Dude, learn your Bible, bro.
it's John 19 in my Bible. I've got a different one. I wrote it in. So this is from Richard Rohr. Who you know him. He's a great
He's a Catholic. He's Father Richard Rohr.
Okay. Yeah. It says OFM. I don't know what that OFM stands for. Richard Rohr, OFM.
Official Franciscan Monk. I think it may be Franciscan Monk.
Is it really? Okay. So this is a famous quote from him that I thought it was apt. It says, there are two ways of being a prophet. One is to tell the enslaved that they can be free. It's the difficult path of Moses. The second is to tell those who think they are free that they are in fact enslaved. This is the even more difficult path of Jesus.
Wow.
So that's what you were just talking about.
Wow.
Being blind but thinking that you're the one that can see and pitying people around you. But then Jesus comes and says, like, no, you're the blind one.
Order of Friars Minor Capuchin is what it means. So I was close.
You were so close.
Order of, he's a friar.
Only a few letters off.
Man. No, and I think you're exactly right. And the great thing is that if all of us who hear that message should hear it daily in our faith, because the best place to start is always there. And I was so guilty of my own Phariseeism. Phariseeism is just blindness towards your own need.
Yeah.
That's really at its it is filled with good deeds. It's filled with right and wrong. Like when they told Jesus, you can't do this on the Sabbath, that was their best interpretation. In fact, they even said, let's give glory to God, but we don't know who this guy is.
Right.
Like what they were saying was, and they proclaimed themselves throughout that story, we are disciples of Moses. Mm. We don't know who this guy is. Meaning, we'll acknowledge the good thing that has happened as long as it fits into our viewpoint of of Judaism, in that case, our viewpoint of what it means to follow God. But anything outside of that, we literally will deny the very miracle that is undeniable. And they threw the guy out. They took the guy who was healed and they excommunicated him from themselves on the greatest day of his life.
Yeah.
The people of faith who should have been serving him and rejoicing with him, including his parents, they all said, nah, it's too much risk to lose what I've always known to be true. I would rather stay in the dark. It's very matrixy than find out that what I've always thought might have another chapter, another testament, if you will.
Boom.
A new testament.
New
Johnny.
Testament. We're back at Stephen Wiley. My wife was laughing so hard that I still knew the rap.
Dude, you killed Stephen it, Wiley. Man.
Oh my gosh!
One of our listeners, Jim, he knows all those guys. Are we gonna have
is
to get
he really
Jim.
Oh,
knows.
We gotta get him on because I looked up Stephen Wiley when I was out with Curry, and I said, "Let's see what he's doing now." He's a Bible professor in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Oh, wow, you're kidding! And I wonder if he does the rap every day for all the.
I think his last record, according to Wikipedia, was like 2000.
Dude, Jim knew every single he was rattling off things that. You and him would just sit for hours.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
man.
Total early, like, Christian metal, Christian rap.
Oh, yeah.
Junkie. Like, he was saying things that I kind of knew, you know, but then
who
I'm kind of.
Who is this?
Jim Calhoun tends
to. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Our daughters play on the same volleyball team.
No, I love it, man.
Jim, we're calling you out. Let's, we want you to be a guest on
we
Talk
need
About
like
That.
We need to have him on, and we need to do random, like, Christian pop culture trivia.
Oh, yeah.
And then we'll have a challenge.
I was fascinated. Like he was flooring me with his knowledge, and it was very much like sitting with you, just like a wealth of worthless, useless information.
It has no meaning, and
if only we could use it for the forces of good. You know, you are a formidable opponent and a wonderful teammate in Trivial Pursuit.
Yeah,
I will say that
we've not played in a long time.
Was that Christmas, that staff Christmas party?
You know what we should do? Because you'll have some time off for the holidays.
Sure.
We should have a game night at my house. We can invite some of the people over. Because you've not been over to the new house, except just to hang. We went to meet over like for
house.
Dinner and to hang. That's what
was at your house 2 weeks
we
ago.
We need to have like a game, like a Vols game and the play in Missouri this weekend.
Oh.
Big game.
Did you know this is...
That Kentucky game was impressive.
Are we going to talk about this?
Well, we're almost done. We're wrapping it up.
I have heard from a few viewers that they're like, you know, I follow everything y'all do, but if they're not a Vol fan, so we try to limit some of the Vols.
Well,
talk.
Let me just say, imagine your team was so not favored. You're playing a ranked opponent. This is a really rebuilding time for the Vols.
Yeah.
It was a big signature win. And so just imagine, put yourself in our shoes. It was a big, refreshing and surprising win.
What was surprising is we lost our best player on the team to blood clots, Trey Smith.
Yeah.
And he was their only guy who could block. And suddenly the offensive line blocked everybody. And that was a great defense.
Yeah.
Like they stopped, and we ran for 235 yards or something on them.
Sports is just cool in that way. I like the story within the story. And you know what? I can get Curry into sports if she knows the story.
Right.
She won't just go, oh, throw the ball out there. Let's see what's happening. I don't care. Like I could just watch sports to do it.
Yeah.
But it always draws you in when you know, like, okay, this guy's coming back from his second knee surgery. He's a fifth-year senior. Like, it's do or die. He's got – if he's going to get in the draft – I mean, if she knows all that, then she's all in. She watches every 30 for 30 and balls. Even the ones about like soccer players, she'll just cry.
They are good. And, hey, speaking of, and I can't really say what it is, but I mean, you talked about it, I'm actually headed to Indiana on Sunday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
There is a situation that was on ESPN story that has to do with Purdue University, that there's some writing that they want done in a situation. It's kind of a tragic situation, but you can say a prayer for me because I'm going to go
there
and
try to. Yeah, it's a time of the essence for sure in this situation. So.
Yeah, I'm going to go and try to help and serve in a situation that's difficult, but it's a crazy and beautiful story.
It is, and now you're built to do it. It's going to be great.
Well,
I can't wait.
Yeah, I don't know. I never feel like it's an honor to get to go.
Yeah,
I get to experience things as a writer.
Well, it's always cool to be a part of somebody's story anyway. And now, you know, this person's, it's heavy and it's an honor. It's cool.
Yeah. And again, I'm sorry to do that to y'all. We can't talk about it until, there's some paperwork and things that are happening, but I'm just not at liberty to speak about it yet.
It's going
to
be cool.
But it's fun to get to write. I really want to write, okay, you want to know a bucket list. If anybody out there.
Okay.
One of the things, and we've pitched a couple things, my agent and I and other things, but just one of my bucket list things is I love to write for a UT coach. And Rick Barnes is that guy. He's amazing, the basketball coach.
Yeah.
I mean, he came to faith, a crazy story. His children led him to faith. And he was just kind of living, he's speaking all kinds of places. I don't think he's ready for a book yet kind of thing. But
once we win the national championship this year in basketball.
Gosh, they're number five. It's the first time we've been ranked number five since.
We got a lot to lose this year. We've always just been off the radar. Now we're on the radar. These big teams are coming for us. We're going to play in the preseason tournaments.
Well, we had an off night.
When do we
night.
Play like a North Carolina Duke type team? When do we
next
play
week.
Them? We play who do we play?
Okay, next week we play Louisville on Tuesday.
Yeah.
But they're not even ranked this year.
But that's post-Patino
but
era,
if you win, you know you play number two Kansas. Or Marquette, but Kansas will probably beat Marquette in their round, and then
Duke
they'll play.
Looks just otherworldly.
Zion Williamson, bro,
he is 285 pounds, 6 foot. Eight.
Listen, you may hate basketball, listeners, but I want to tell you something.
Unreal.
You need to go Google first couple games at Duke. We watched it while we were in Dallas. Then play Kentucky.
His chest is above the rim on a couple of those alley oops.
Above the rim, and he's a freshman. His first game in college basketball against number two Kentucky.
Yeah,
and.
They embarrassed
him. And he's huge.
Yeah.
He can play all five positions. They literally had him bringing the ball up like a point guard.
Ridiculous.
And then his speed to the basket, what is he, 260 minimum?
He's 285.
285. I mean, he's not even like
J.J. Watt could play basketball like LeBron James. That's what they were saying. It's the body of J.J. Watt.
It is, because LeBron's this huge guy, but he's kind of ripped and cut.
Yeah.
He's not necessarily a...
He's deceptively fast, too, though.
But this guy, his speed to the basket, mm-hmm. in those five-star Kentucky players, it was like they were standing still.
Crazy.
And then he would just go up from, the free-throw line. I mean, I've never... Anyway, he's a freshman. His first game, he scored 28 points and, 13 rebounds or something. I've never seen anything like it. So you need to go.
There's tape on everybody now on the Vols. That's the thing is that's when you can't sneak up on anybody. We'll see what we have this year, but got a lot of seniors on the team.
Well, we have a lot of
good
opportunities.
Good chemistry.
There's articles and it's always you have a lot of opportunities in November and December to make statements that will make a difference because that's easy.
It's just all about your seeding. It's all about the tournament. Yeah.
It is, and they'll Georgia Tech was a hard game. We actually were off and still won by 10.
So many fouls called in that game.
It was rough.
I read the stats and it was 40 fouls called.
I mean, they were just...
48 fouls in 40 minutes is what they said.
They were just beating each other up, man. It was, really, really physical. And we didn't shoot well, and they still won. They kept the lead the whole game, and that's
a big
deal.
So that was your Vol update, and we're sorry. We're not really sorry, but hang in there with us. We're rebuilding in football. We have reason to be optimistic, and then basketball, we're kind of turning the corner.
Yeah.
We're getting back to, the Bruce Pearl excitement days. To where it's we're a prominent program again.
I actually like this team better than those teams. I love those guys and Chris Lofton and everything, but I like the demeanor of these teams.
This feels more like we got two or three Ron Slay types on this team.
Well,
they're outspoken and they're fun.
Yeah, the difference between this team and those teams is those teams used to get fouled. It was they're emotional like Bruce Pearl.
All right.
And I like that sometimes, but it was always the wrong call. They never just – these guys, when it's the bad call, they kind of just – they look disappointed, but they take on the demeanor of Rick. They don't freak out.
Yeah.
Kentucky, every time they get fouled, oh, my gosh. They're running around because that's what Calipari does.
That's the best impression of a Kentucky player.
Oh, my gosh. I got fouled.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. So, Valley Girl.
Sorry to our Kentucky listeners.
Yeah. Listen.
Both
we beat
you.
Kentucky twice last year in the regular season and lost by six or something in the tournament them. So, but this is going to be a different year. It'll be hard. We may not win everything, but I think we could make a deep run.
We got to go to a game.
Oh, I'm going.
So game night at my house, then we'll go to a game.
They just announced SEC men's basketball tournament. You know, went to St. Louis for a year.
So you're saying it's going to be back in Vegas.
It's going to be.
Or back in.
It's going to be in the
Bridgestone.
From here till 2030.
What?
And possibly with an extension in 2035 for the exception of 2022 when it's going to Tampa. So literally, it's going to be in Nashville from here.
So when I said politicians sign off on things and there's unexpected
this was good, though.
This is, it's good because it affects you. All these other tiny schools that can't get an event, they're like, 2030?
Every SEC team gets
it's
to come and
fine,
benefit from it.
John,
I'm going to go to basketball games like you've never seen. So it's going to
okay,
be great.
I'll go with
so,
I'll go.
And you're all invited out there, listeners. Let's just get a big bus together.
Oh, yeah. The big orange.
Hey, I really do want to put one thing out there as we close the day about an idea that we've had. And so you may not even like this idea, Johnny, but I'm just curious.
If we've had it, how could I not
well,
like it?
Well, I don't remember that we came to a consensus, and now I'm speaking about it publicly to our millions of listeners. But we are approaching episode 50.
Yep.
And that's a pretty big milestone, Johnny. That's the golden episode.
What do you get from me?
Well, I'm wondering if we don't sometime in the near future put together a live recording of Talk About That with people present.
Oh, I think that'd be cool.
You think that'd be fun?
Do you think listeners would want to come to it?
Well, that's the idea. Is that we do a thing, we invite listeners to come and hang out. Maybe we can do some sort of event
that'd be
night.
Neat.
Yeah. And maybe we could take some like audience
sell
questions.
Sell some tickets, give the money away to charity.
I don't know. Let's not add too many caveats that will keep them from
$5 ticket. They're going to spend $5 anyway. $5 ticket, and then we give the money away to, you know, whatever.
We'd have to have at least
Calcutta Mercy that night.
I need to have at least 10 people either email or tweet us to say that they'd be interested in that, for us to make it a valid thing. So you can email me at John, J-O-H-N, at johndriver.com,
yeah.
Or you can direct tweet if you want me and Johnny, JONNIE_W, or at John_driver. Like, I need feedback on this. And I'm sorry I didn't get to the questions today with our segment and our cool music, but you wanted to talk about history the whole time.
I did.
And I know how you feel about that, so... Yeah. But hey, we are always just honored, honestly, that you listen. Every time we hear from listeners, it's just, you know, it's just cool. It's cool that we get to share this. Me and Johnny dreamed. We used to want to do a radio show back before podcasts were a thing, you know. We wanted to call it John and Johnny in the Mornings. Remember that? But we hate getting up in the mornings. That's what's crazy.
Yeah.
But this is actually fun for us, and we think that we get to talk about things that are enjoyable but also important. So send us your questions, your comments, share it with somebody out there, and appreciate you being a part of what we're doing here on
Talk About That.
Hi, I'm Zach.
And I'm Randy.
And we're from Salty Saints Podcast. We're a theology and apologetics podcast.
We hope to better equip you to be salt and light for your community. We hope that we can help you to go out and be a reflection of Jesus Christ to those around you, to your friends and your family, and especially to those that do not know Christ.
To find out more, subscribe at lifeaudio.com.